Coming up,
what kinds of moral and ethical dilemmas are people facing related to the pandemic and social distancing?
We ask you to tell us about your experiences.
I've prepared for everything I can think of, but if I need help, do I ask my friends and neighbors, knowing that however careful we are, there's still some risk to them?
I find the peer pressure to conform to risk minimization almost impossible to overcome.
Now I'm really confused, and I don't know if I'm like a person who could call the Gestapo on Jews hiding somewhere.
Knowing that this virus highlights social inequalities, does that change the ethics of our individual behavior?
Should we be relishing in the time that we've all been granted away from everyone to learn a new skill, develop ourselves in some way, or find alternative ways to be productive?
Do I bite it and stay? Can I do that to them? Should I do that to them? I don't know.
COVID conundrums and moral dilemmas.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. What moral dilemmas and conundrums has COVID raised for you?
Are you wondering what to do when people around you break the rules?
Is it ever okay to put workers at risk by ordering non-essential goods?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from our respective shelters in place via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about COVID conundrums and moral dilemmas.
Recently, we asked you to tell us if there's an ethical quandary or moral dilemma you've had to confront in the age of COVID and social distancing.
We got a lot of calls and emails. So on today's program, we're going to try to work through as many of them as we can.
And we'll have a guest ethicist here to help us. Between the three of us, we hope we can provide at least some philosophical insight about your dilemmas.
I don't know if we'll actually resolve any of them, but we'll certainly try to give you lots more to think about.
You know, I'm curious, Ray, to hear what you've been thinking after social distancing for how long has it been now?
Decades.
Yeah, well, certainly a large number of weeks at any rate. So are there any ethical dilemmas that have been particularly weighing on your mind?
Oh, yeah, lots. So for instance, like, what if I have only one mask and I'm going out for a walk with Blossom? Should I wear the mask or should I give it to her?
Wait a minute. Isn't Blossom your dog?
Well, yeah, but she depends on me. So don't I have a special obligation to her?
Well, you know what Du Bois would have said.
No, what?
Get a cat.
But I don't have a cat-sized mask.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Are there any non-pet related questions that have been troubling you?
Well, actually, one thing I've been thinking about is how to ethically order food to support local restaurants. I worry that the apps underpay their workers. But then if I try to tip on the app, like, will the app take it away from the worker? And on the other hand, if I give them cash, will the cash be sort of contaminated and dangerous for them? So I'm sort of not sure what the right thing to do is in that situation.
So is there any way to make sure the cash isn't contaminated?
What I've been doing is just putting it aside in an envelope for a couple of days to sort of let any virus decay, and then only handling it after I wash my hands and then putting it outside my door for them.
That's pretty smart.
Yeah, I mean, it's the best thing I can think of. What about you, Josh? Is there anything that you've encountered recently that's got you stumped?
Yeah, I have to say, one thing I've been wondering a lot about is what we can do for our healthcare workers. Like, I'm all for applauding them. I think that's actually lovely and wonderful. But is that the limit of our obligation towards them? And, like, shouldn't we be advocating for them? More PPE, increased pay, maybe even a different healthcare system altogether?
Yeah, I find that one way trickier than the one about restaurants, because as an individual, I can at least work out how to tip somebody in, like, a minimally risky way. But as an individual, what can I do for healthcare workers who need systemic change?
Yeah, and that's obviously a really difficult thing. Obviously, we can write to our senators, and maybe we can donate to organizations, campaigns, candidates. How about, like, maybe donating an organ to Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
I mean, we can't all do that. But also, another thing we can do is just stay at home so that healthcare workers don't have as much strain put on them. But honestly, I'm just glad that I'm not an advice columnist and I'm a philosopher instead, like, especially now during a global pandemic when nobody knows what to do.
I know exactly what you mean. I find it much easier to make philosophical distinctions than to dispense advice. So how are actual advice columnists handling the current situation? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out. She files this report.
When it comes to COVID-19, there are the big questions, like when will this end and how bad will this get? Then there are the personal questions that people dispatch to advice columnists, like this one sent to Slate's advice column, Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence, my roommate is a concert pianist who was furloughed because of the coronavirus. I am working from home. She spends 8+ hours a day practicing, even though she's not going to be playing in the orchestra for the foreseeable future.
The advice to the letter writer? Be nice to the concert pianist.
I will try to imagine a world in which having someone like play beautiful concert piano music from 5 p.m. until bedtime is a problem. But I get that life is a rich tapestry and different things bother different people.
In a letter to Judge John Hotman's online column, someone named Megan inquires about whether she should wear a face mask while playing the Animal Crossing computer game.
My sister wants to require that all visitors to her island wear virtual face masks. I feel this ruins the escapism of the game.
The judge's answer to Megan is direct. Your sister's island, your sister's rules. Be kind seems to be the common refrain of the advice columnist.
One of my early struggles was like, I don't know what to do either.
John Paul Bramer writes the popular Hola Poppy advice column. He describes himself as a Twitter-addled gay Mexican with anxiety, and he says he's no expert on the daily challenges of a pandemic.
I don't know how to tackle this moment we're in. I don't necessarily have advice for anyone else.
Bramer knew he didn't just want to make people feel better. He also wanted to figure out how to present the truth without making things feel even worse. And more letters kept pouring in.
So what I did was I read all the letters I got recently several times. And while every situation is unique, they're all sort of similar in that they all have to sort of genuflect to the big thing, which is COVID-19 right now.
He says these days, many of the questions he's getting are about internal struggles, people coping with themselves. There are also lots of letters about spending too much time with other people. In one letter, a person who calls himself Heartbreaker asks if it's okay to break up in quarantine.
Hola, Poppy. How can I deal with my guilt about ending things when the world feels like it's ending? Am I heartless for wanting to end a 3-year relationship at a time when everyone else seems to be clamoring for connections? Signed, Heartbreaker.
Poppy tells Heartbreaker he might be a bad guy for other reasons, but not this one.
Breakups can be heartlessly done, but they are not, in and of themselves, heartless acts. I think a lot of us are clinging to the idea that some things haven't changed. I don't know about you, but that impulse hasn't brought me much peace at all.
When people write to Hola Poppy, often they're just looking to be heard. The scientists can tell us how far apart to stand and how long viruses stay on doorknobs. But Bramer says when the facts feel overwhelming, there's advice columnists like him waiting with electronic mailboxes open.
The absolute brutal reality of the situation is a lot to handle, and it can make people want even more. Some figure that they can see as a friend that they can sort of just lay all their problems out to. Because while it's super important to have all the facts, it's also important to get your feelings out there.
You could write a letter asking Dr. Fauci for advice on a breakup. But practically speaking, if you're going to ask a stranger for personal advice, it might as well be a thoughtful, well-intentioned columnist on the internet. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that great advice, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs, and today we're thinking about moral and ethical dilemmas in the age of COVID-19.
We're joined now by Karen Storr, who's a professor of philosophy at Georgetown University and the author of Minding the Gap, Moral Ideals and Moral Improvement. Karen, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So Karen, you've been writing a coronavirus ethics column for the Washingtonian magazine, but you're a philosopher, so how did you get interested in advice columns?
So I've always loved reading advice columns ever since I was a teenager. I always looked forward to reading them in the newspaper. And then when I was in graduate school, you know, if you're doing a PhD in a field like philosophy, it's always good to have a backup plan in case the job market doesn't work out for you. And my backup plan was that I was going to try to be the next Miss Manners, because I thought, well, you know, what could be more fun than telling people what to do all the time? But philosophy did work out. So I didn't end up working as an advice columnist. And that's probably for the best, because I actually think it would be much harder to be an advice columnist than to be a philosopher. But I have been having a lot of fun moonlighting as a kind of ethics advice columnist for the Washingtonian magazine. I've had a longstanding interest in manners as a philosophical topic, just because I think that there's a lot of sort of moral work or a lot of ethical activity that goes on in the realm of manners. And so I think that process of trying to figure out what we should do is pretty similar, whether we're thinking about it as philosophers or whether we're thinking about it as advice columnists.
So Karen, do you think that people should be turning specifically to ethicists and philosophers for advice?
Yeah, that's a good question, because of course, philosophers are known for being sort of useless when it comes to practical problems. But I actually think that's not quite true. Not perhaps as useless as we might seem. I think one reason why philosophers and ethicists might seem useless is that we have a tendency to generate what seems like more confusion than people brought to the table. So people come thinking they've got a simple question and they're looking for a simple answer. But if you ask a philosopher, what happens is that the answer is never simple, and it will often turn out that your question wasn't actually all that simple in the first place. So sometimes people find this really frustrating because they were looking for a concrete answer, and that's not really what philosophers do. But I don't think this is a bad thing, because I think very often the questions that people are bringing to the table really are a lot more complicated than they think, or at least they open up a lot of space for conversations that extend well beyond that question and take us into territory that is definitely in the realm of ethics. If we're talking about things like respect or fairness or justice or inequality, those are definitely in the realm of ethics. And so I think the questions that people raise that really trouble them are ones that already bring up philosophical considerations. And so then I think it's not such a bad thing to have philosophers as part of that conversation, even if we end up making it more complicated.
I agree. I guess that's fair warning for the rest of the show.
Yes. Right?
Sometimes we might have actual advice, and sometimes we might just have a way of complexifying the question. Even where we have actual advice, that's just our opinion. And as good existentialists, I guess we probably agree that ultimately we each take responsibility for making the choices that we do.
I'm really curious about why etiquette is philosophical.
So I think it depends a lot on how we think about etiquette in the first place. So very often people just think of etiquette as, you know, the order in which you place the forks and pick them up, or how you answer an invitation of the third person. I mean, those are technically in the realm of etiquette, but they're not all of etiquette, and they're not the most interesting things about etiquette as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the way that I think about manners, it's our way of sort of acknowledging to other people that we see them and that they matter. And manners are our way of sort of moving through social space, whether we're talking about our physical presence or our presence in social media. Those are ways in which we express attitudes toward people. And those are moral attitudes. You know, are we acknowledging people's presence, people's needs, people's desires? And the way that comes out very often is through what we think of as sort of the rules of manner or the rules of etiquette. So I think that they do actually have quite a lot of moral importance, because they do express in a whole range of ways how we're thinking about ourselves in relationship to other people. So I think it's a lot more than forks. Although I think the fork part is kind of interesting, I think that etiquette is about way more than that. And actually, I think the coronavirus epidemic is kind of showing that, because all the questions that people have about, you know, sort of how to, you know, get groceries and how to, you know, navigate around joggers on narrow paths, all those questions are questions about etiquette or manners, but now they take on a new importance for us because they become part of how we're working out this very different kind of physical and social space that we're now in.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about moral dilemmas in the time of COVID with Karen Storr from Georgetown University.
Coming up, we'll dig into the COVID conundrums that you've sent us over the last several weeks. Like, how do you balance mental health with physical health? And what should you do if your roommates refuse to follow the rules? And how can you cultivate your virtues while sheltering in place?
Your COVID conundrums, when Philosophy Talk continues.
I've been in here too long. Vegetable cutters. I've been in here too long. Vegetable cutters.
Hand me those bolt cutters, Ray. I've been in this living room way too long. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about moral dilemmas in the age of COVID with Karen Storr from Georgetown University.
So Karen, let's get right into it and hear what issues people out there are grappling with. Our first conundrum has to do with putting other people at risk.
This is Nancy from Berkeley. My conundrum is about asking others for help if I get COVID-19. I'm 69, so in the high-risk group, but not old. I live alone, and I have pets, including two I'm fostering for a closed shelter. I've prepared for everything I can think of, but if I need help, and if my animals do, do I ask my friends and neighbors, knowing that however careful we are, there's still some risk to them? If my doctor tells me to go to the hospital and I can't drive myself, but I don't really need an ambulance, do I ask someone to drive me, or do I call for an ambulance anyway? Perhaps denying it to someone who needs it more urgently.
Thanks so much for that great question, Nancy. What do you think, Karen?
So I think it's wonderful both that Nancy is planning ahead and also that she's so considerate of the risks that she might be putting onto other people. I mean, I think it's straightforward. If you have an emergency and you need to call for help, you should call for help. That's fine. But thinking through who you should call for help and what's fair, I think is a really great question.
So what are some considerations we might have here, Karen? Like, is it better to ask a friend to do it where you might put that friend at risk of contagion? Or is it better to ask like an Uber driver where it might feel like you're kind of exploiting that person? I mean, doesn't Bernard Williams have that thing about the one thought too many, that you actually should sometimes give priority to your family members, right? Maybe you should be trying more to protect your friends and family members from contagion than other people. But that doesn't seem quite right to me. What do you think, Karen?
Yeah, it doesn't seem quite right to me either. I mean, it's easier to repay your family or friend. On the other hand, you can pay your Uber driver and give them a really big tip, which is what I would do in this case. I think it depends on how well your Uber driver can protect themselves, whether they have access to protective equipment, and also the same with your friends and family member. I'd probably ask a friend or family member first, but I think if it were an emergency, I wouldn't hesitate to call Uber or an ambulance.
Let's get to our next one. This one's from Margaret in Traverse City, Michigan. She writes, I'd like to hear people discuss the ethics of ordering non-essential items online. Is your desire to have comforts more important than the health of warehouse and delivery workers? So what do you think about that one, Karen?
Well, when you put it that way, the answer is definitely no. Of course, it's not more important than your health. But of course, it's also not that simple. Here we go, complicating things. This is complicated. And I say this as someone who's been ordering all kinds of non-essential things and feeling guilty about it. The challenge is trying to figure out just how much we're putting other people at risk when we're doing this, because we're supporting the economy. On the other hand, we want to make sure that we are not unfairly burdening other people. And that is very hard to know.
I'm also a little bit puzzled about these cases because I can be helping one set of people economically while ordering a non-essential item. Like if I order something from an artist on Etsy, I'm helping the artist, but then somebody has to deliver it. So I'm hurting somebody else. How do I balance that?
I mean, I think we can make choices here about what we order and where we order it from. And I think we definitely have a moral responsibility to make those choices well in terms of what companies we order from, what businesses we support, what their practices are, and also in terms of advocating for things like access to health insurance and sick leave for employees of major companies.
That seems like a really good thought. And of course, buying things as as Ray was saying, from individuals or from mom and pop shops. One other thought I had about this is what counts actually as non-essential? Because, right, I can imagine a lot of things being non-essential, but if we deprived ourselves of all frivolities, I wonder if we wouldn't actually get worse at taking care of each other. I think of it as like the oxygen mask wisdom, right? You put your own oxygen mask on first before you put it on your kids, because if you're out of commission, that's going to harm them. So do you think there's room for each of us getting at least one or two things that just keep us sane during these times so we can actually be better contributors to the sort of the welfare of the general community?
Well, I think what keeps us sane is essential by definition. it's hard to, because like you could make an essential trip to the grocery store and, you know, buy something like Captain Crunch, which I've been doing, which is definitely not essential. So it does get pretty hard to determine what is really essential and what can you just grab because you're in the store and there it is. I don't really know how to work this out. I think being mindful of what we're doing and the impact that we're having on other people is the crucial thing. And also being honest with ourselves about that impact, which is hard to do.
So we've got another submission. This one's from a listener on the East Coast who's thinking about people affected by illnesses other than COVID-19 right now.
Hi, my name's Emma and I'm calling from Connecticut. Thank you for this discussion and for taking my question. It seems as though we're approaching this crisis as if we have plenty of time to recover from it. But regardless of COVID, none of us is guaranteed tomorrow, and on average, 2.7 million Americans die each year. So for 2.7 million people in the US, this new reality is how they may be spending the last few weeks or months of their lives, possibly completely alone, terrified of human contact. As we weigh the costs of this approach, is that an appropriate trade-off?
Thank you, Emma, for that good question. What do you think, Karen?
So I think this is a heartbreaking question. And Emma is exactly right about some of the other costs that we're not seeing, or we may not be seeing, of this epidemic. And I don't have an answer to that question. It's one of these things that's incredibly challenging for all of us to work out. To what extent are we posing risks to other people? Lots of us are in a position where we want to go see someone we love, perhaps someone who's older, who has a life-threatening condition, but we're afraid of making them sick. And that's an incredibly difficult position to be in and a hard question to answer.
Yeah, I worry particularly about the kind of psychological effects of isolation on people, because there's a cost to not isolating, which is that more people will get sick and die, but there's also a cost to isolating, which is that sort of not everybody can maintain their mental health without human contact.
There are, I think, additional challenges when we're talking about people who may not be in a position to understand what's going on or what the cause of the isolation is, and thinking of older people with dementia or Alzheimer's. Then the cost of isolation become even more poignant, because just because people aren't necessarily in a position to understand why their friends and family members have stopped visiting them.
Oh, yes, that's a terrible situation. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about ethical dilemmas that you've been facing in the age of COVID. Our guest is Georgetown University philosopher Karen Storr, who's been writing a coronavirus ethics column for the Washingtonian magazine. Ray, I believe you've got another conundrum for us.
This is Rocky from Atlanta, who writes, "A lot of people, myself included, are having a really rough time with their mental health from not seeing, touching, or interacting with their friends and partners. Thinking from a harm reduction framework, is there a point where it's appropriate to break quarantine to see another person in order to reduce the damage to your emotional or mental health? And if so, what is that point and how do you do it ethically?"
So mental health is health and it's essential. I mean, it is. And I think for people to think, well, I don't really have to do this, we shouldn't downplay emotional and mental health needs. You know, that being said, we clearly have a responsibility to do that as safely as we possibly can. And so that's going to mean limiting your contact as much as you can and doing everything you can to reduce the risk to that person and to others that you have contacts with.
Right. I'm thinking maybe a principle here is that I can't do this for everybody in my life, because that would just obviate the point of isolating. So it seems like there's a little bit of a, if you're going to sort of see people in person, you sort of have to decide whom, which seems like not the best situation. Like, I don't want to pick among my friends, but at some point I have to make a practical choice.
You kind of have to.
Yeah.
I think there, I mean, thinking of ways to find those connections, you know, to the extent that you can do it safely, you know, thinking about, well, you know, being with friends outside, you know, trying to maintain as much space as you can, it doesn't completely minimize the need that humans have for physical contact, but there might be things that we could do to ameliorate some of those negative effects of isolation that don't actually put others or us at increased risk, or not much increased risk.
Well, you know, thinking of risk and difficult balances, we've got this question from a listener in the Bay Area.
This is David from Mountain View in Santa Clara County, California.
Through all this coronavirus stuff, I'm learning that I'm more of a risk balancer who thinks about economic risk versus virus risk. Almost all my friends are rule-following risk minimizers who only think about virus risk. I find the peer pressure to conform to risk minimization almost impossible to overcome, and I find myself becoming a risk minimizer with my actions. Which is fine, because I don't want to lose any of my friends. That said, is there something to be said about comparing the risk of economic disaster due to shutting everything down to the risk of allowing the virus to run unchecked and going about my day as if there were simply another variety of flu?
Thanks for the great question, David. Okay, so Karen, what do you think?
So I think David is raising a couple of different issues. One is about sort of how we should think about risk more generally. And then one is about how we should interact with our more or less risk-averse friends. And I think those are worth thinking about differently. No doubt David is right about the economic risk being important too, but I think his question is really about that interacting with people who just take a different idea about risk than you do. And that is definitely challenging.
I also wanted to ask about sort of what exactly the economic risks are and who bears them. So it seems like some of the economic risks accrue to sort of like small businesses or to people who are now unemployed. But also, I worry a lot about like people who were already unemployed, who were maybe homeless. So that seems like a place where I wish we had more of a safety net. And I'm kind of worried about how to coordinate a good response that we sort of make sure that economic help goes to the people who need it most.
Well, I think that economic risk needs to be broken down, of course, into the kinds of things that we're talking about, because there's, you know, there's a failure of small businesses, and then there's also what that might mean for people's access to things like healthcare, you know, or adequate food, which affect their physical health too. And so it definitely is really complicated, and it would be much less complicated if we had more of a safety net, so we didn't have to worry so much about our neighbors going hungry when their business fails. I think that it does help us to frame the risks in terms of a variety of different considerations, but we don't want to let or lose sight of the fact both that some people are bearing more risk than others, and also that some of these risks are just much more serious than others. You know, if someone is dead, nothing else matters much. And I think all of us need to have a fair bit of humility in terms of what we know. You know, people are really confident about what will happen or what won't happen if we do different things. The fact is, none of us really know. No one has the magic potion, and we're all kind of trying to work this mess without a clear vision of what the risks really are.
We have another listener all the way from Louisiana with a question about the demographics of the disease.
This is Leslie from Baton Rouge. Here in Louisiana, we have seen very grim statistics this week demonstrating that COVID-19 disproportionately impacts communities of color. At the same time, I'm hearing that many of my fellow citizens are frustrated by the stay-at-home order. They say we should be targeting our public health measures much more narrowly. And I'm worried. I wonder what you think about the ethics of this situation. Knowing that this virus highlights social inequalities, does that change the ethics of our individual behavior? And how should we think about the ethics of public policy given that fact?
So, Karen, what do you think?
I think Leslie has raised one of the most important questions about the ethics of pandemics, which is how we think about the ways in which risks fall differently on different segments of the population. And the deep ethical question behind that, of course, has to do with injustice and inequality. I mean, it's no surprise to anyone who knows anything about disparities in access to healthcare in our country that certain groups are being more affected by this virus than others. And the question for us as a society is, what are we going to do about that? Now we can't ignore this. And we have a choice about how we're going to respond to this. And the question is, are we going to respond to that well?
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm kind of like worried and pessimistic. Do you think there's anything we can do to increase the probability that we do respond to it well rather than badly, or at least think about it right?
I don't know. I try not to be pessimistic, but on this question, I have to say that I am. I'm worried that people, the longer we're under lockdown and the more inconvenient people find it, and honestly, the more it starts to impinge on people's livelihoods and their ordinary ways of life, the less patient people will be. And I think perhaps the less solidarity they will feel with people who work, say, in meatpacking plants, who are invisible to them, or to people more globally who will be suffering from this, people in refugee camps. It's easy for us to forget about the ways in which other people are impacted by our actions and focus only on our needs. And I think there's a real danger that that's going to happen.
It occurs to me also that thinking about the problem as just the pandemic in isolation is maybe not the right way to think about it. So if there weren't people like stuck in refugee camps, then the pandemic wouldn't be a threat to people stuck in refugee camps. If there weren't so many people stuck in prisons, then the pandemic would be like less of a problem. So I think maybe like a less kind of atomistic way of thinking, where we still have all these other background problems, they don't become not problems because of the pandemic.
If anything, they become worse, because people who are already more socioeconomically vulnerable are in a worse position because of the pandemic than people who were already in a position of privilege. So it exacerbates our existing inequalities.
We have another submission. This one's from Christine in Utah. She writes, people seem to be turning on their neighbors, perceiving one another as a threat. Normal activities like playing at the park are now looked down upon, and neighbors are ready to turn on each other for what were once considered healthy and normal behaviors. So have our personal interpersonal values changed because of COVID? Do we rank values such as fidelity, connection, and empathy differently now? What do you think, Karen?
So here I'm going to channel Mr. Rogers and the quote from him that's often brought out in times like these, which is to look at the helpers. I see what Christine means, but now I'm going to be optimistic here and think, but yes, there are people who, this is not bringing out the best in them, but there are many, many more in whom it is bringing out really good things. And all you have to do is look at EMTs in New York or people who are working in nursing homes. There are so many people who are working so hard to make our situation better that I'm not convinced that all hope is lost.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about COVID quandaries and moral dilemmas with Karen Storr from Georgetown University.
What do you owe your roommates in a time of crisis? What should you do if they behave badly? Are some people just jerks?
More of your conundrums when Philosophy Talk continues. Don't stand so close to me. 6 feet minimum. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Karen Storr from Georgetown University, and we're thinking about your ethical dilemmas in an age of social distancing.
Needless to say, we're not professional advice givers. We're just here to offer different ways to think about these COVID quandaries, and you should take any suggestions we may have with a grain of salt.
Even when they're true and reasonable.
So let's get back to your conundrums. Here's a fellow San Franciscan having some problems with her roommates.
Hello, my name is Natalie. I live with a family. John has a business and he was having clients over to the house during the shelter in place. And he continued to do so until I asked him to stop. On top of that, John and Mary continue to hang out with friends inside the house and outside. When I complained, John told me I was making up laws. I called 311 to see if I was too extreme,
They said no. They said that John and Mary are breaking the law and that I could call the police so that they could come to the house to educate them. I didn't call the police, but I did tell John and Mary that I had called 311. Now they are making me feel like I'm the one who did something wrong, like I betrayed them or something. Now I'm really confused and I don't know if I'm like a person who could call the Gestapo on Jews hiding somewhere.
Wow. Okay. So that's a tough one. Do you have any advice for Natalie, Karen?
Well, I think Natalie needs some new roommates, but that might not be the project solution here. I'm sure she knows that herself. I think she was within her rights to call 311. You know, they are endangering her. That's different from people being judgmental about someone whose behavior they don't like, but that isn't threatening them. I mean, Natalie is made less safe by what John and Mary are doing. And it seems totally fair to me for her to be able to defend herself with the help of the authorities.
Yeah, honestly, this sounds like she wasn't trying to punish them. So there is this like philosophical question, which I have like pretty strong views on, which is like, is it okay to hurt people just because they did something bad? But that's not what's going on here. Like, she's just trying to stop them from doing something that could hurt her and others.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say this is the first conundrum that we've had where I feel very strongly, you know, turn him in. And there's a part of me that goes even further and wonders whether, you know, could Natalie come up with some strategy by which she could, you know, make them feel what it's like for her, like maybe buy a pet snake.
Well, that does sound like punishment. Like, that's different.
Yeah, I know. Almost certainly wrong. Right, Karen?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if Natalie could get through to them, that would obviously be the way to go. But it doesn't sound like that's very likely. And so, you know, I think in this situation, if moving is not an option for her, then the only one she has is to enlist the help of local authorities. Normally, I would say that should be a last resort, but it's hard to see what other options short of a snake Natalie has. But Natalie, the philosophers have your back on this one. I don't know if that's helpful.
And we have another call about roommate issues.
My name is Stephanie. I'm from Chicago. I currently live with two other people in a two-bedroom apartment that is emphatically not big enough. One of my roommates lives on our couch. I don't begrudge them living on our couch at all by any stretch of the imagination, but it does make this apartment very crowded and makes things tense. Due to this and other things, including the distance I travel for work, I am intent on moving out at the end of our lease. My dilemma is related to whether or not I should move out at all. My company just did furloughs. I survived. I did not get furloughed, but it only lasts for 3 months. And if this goes any longer than 3 months, then I'm going to possibly be on that block. My other roommate did get furloughed. She is a manager at a restaurant that attempted 2-3 days of online ordering and delivery and then shut down completely. So she is furloughed. She is receiving unemployment, but the third roommate is the only one currently working. Do I still move out? Do I bite it and stay? Can I do that to them? Should I do that to them?
All right, Karen, so does Stephanie move out?
I think it's all right. I mean, from what she said, she described them as roommates, not friends, which I think does make a difference. That line is hard to draw. But it raises questions about what we owe people and under what circumstances. And she owes them fair treatment. She owes them her share of the rent, whatever she's agreed to. But she does not owe them her permanent presence on the lease.
Is there a question of sort of preserving these relationships and making it so that they can help each other out in the future?
I think so. If Stephanie wants to preserve these relationships, and particularly if her roommate situations become more desperate, then I think there are things that she might consider about what she can do for them beyond living with them. There are ways to help people that don't just amount to living in the same house with them, especially if it's making her anxious. But I do think she wants to take that into account. You know, abandoning people who need us in general is something we should avoid doing. And so I think the extent to which Stephanie can separate out reasonable annoyances from genuine problems, I think would be helpful, because it may be that there are ways in which she can mitigate some of the things that make her situation difficult and enable them to still count on each other to help them get through this.
That's nice. I was wondering about other kinds of compromise, like if she moves out, could she cover the rent for them for a couple of months or something like that? I don't know if that's the kind of thing that you think might mitigate the damage.
I think it would be nice if she could manage that.
We've got another question from a listener in the South. This one's more kind of a self-reflective question.
This is Karen, and I'm sending a memo from New Orleans. How has the coronavirus pandemic changed things already going on in your life prior to this period of physical isolation or quarantine? This is to say, what kind of impact has this global crisis had on more ordinary local sorts of life crises? How has this experience of living in this particular moment in time caused you to reevaluate or reconsider certain aspects of your life? And what has surprised you most about whatever changes it's forced upon you? Thanks.
So Karen, what are your thoughts on that?
So on a light note, I've always been the kind of person who has a lot of toilet paper around and people make fun of me for that. And now I feel so vindicated by that. I'm even able to give toilet paper away. More seriously, this has really, I think, shown the differences in sort of levels of privilege. I think it both sort of in our broader community, but also more locally, who has to go to work under what circumstances. But I think it also lends to kind of a feeling of neighborliness, at least for me. People are much more likely to check on their neighbors, to see how people are doing. There's different kinds of communities have arisen in virtue of this pandemic. And, you know, there's pluses and minuses to that.
Yeah. Can I contribute a thing that I feel like this has changed for me, is that I've noticed that a lot of the things that I was doing before might be things that I could drop now that I realize they're inessential. Like, I traveled a lot for work and I'm going to all these conferences on Zoom now, and it's pretty great and it's a lot less environmentally costly.
That's a thought I had too, right? So I take Karen's point about a kind of revelation of features of our society we weren't aware of, sometimes horrifying features. And I take your point too, right? That, you know, maybe the kinds of some of the skills that we're developing now, some of the habits we're developing now, could carry over in a really productive way to a different kind of future. I mean, think about working from home, conferences from home, but working from home. I think about all the homeless people. And on the other side, most of us live in two spaces, one by day, one by night. What if there was a revolution in social space after this? If there was a lot more working from home, which would free up more spaces for people to live. So maybe there could be a silver lining to this massive cloud.
Yeah, we might see sort of a renewed attention to the importance of public spaces, especially green spaces that are near people's houses, places where people can get away from others, but also be with others. I could see a lot of positive changes. You know, I have a couple of teenagers and I'm spending a whole lot more time with them than I was before. And there are pluses and minuses to this, but as a mother, I would say they're mostly pluses. I don't know what they would say.
I do.
We've got time for one last conundrum. This one comes from all the way across the pond in Ireland.
Hi, guys. My name is Brian and I'm from Ireland. And my question is, should we be relishing in the time that we've all been granted away from everyone to do a full detox of all the things that are stress provoking? Or should we be using the time to learn a new skill, develop ourselves in some way, or find alternative ways to be productive? This is somewhat an opportunity cost dilemma, or more like the paradox of choice.
So Karen, what do you say?
Well, this is obviously a great opportunity to pick up some skills. On the other hand, I don't think we should put too much pressure on ourselves to suddenly become these bread baking, gardening, Instagramming experts. That's not realistic. It is a stressful situation that we're in. So maybe the answer is kind of both. Use it as an opportunity to rethink the way in which we've been living and try to figure out what matters to us, but also not put pressure on us to write King Lear or its equivalent, because that's also not going to happen for most of us.
Yes, definitely not going to happen for me. I like that way of putting it, right? If, you know, don't put pressure on yourself, but also think about what might be the more or less important skills to pick up if you do feel able and ready and excited to do that. I mean, I go back to Christine's question, like how is our sense of ethics changing? And it, on the one end, it seems like some forms of ethical interaction are being weakened. On the other hand, you know, you don't know what you got till it's gone. I think actually this situation, as you were saying earlier, Karen, that's, it's really bringing home to us the importance of community. So I guess what I'd like to see is folks working on skills of social interaction that can come in handy later, right? So certainly skills of self-soothing, meditation, stoic wisdom, things like that, but maybe also the new forms of sociability we've all been cultivating, and a kind of caring spirit, a way of differentiating between what I need and what the world needs from me. That's, I guess, what I'd really love us all to be doing if, you know, again, if we have time between taking care of teenagers. What about you, Ray?
Well, you know, I decided I was going to be productive and learn a bunch of philosophy, and I read Xuanzi, and Xuanzi told me that I should be useless.
Are you being useless, Karen?
I hope not. I think one of the things that I think this, the pandemic brings home is the importance of attention. You know, I think it's Iris Murdoch who described love as a form of attention to people. And I think one of the things that we should be aiming to maintain is attention, not to people as vectors of disease, but to people as people. And that is a really easy thing to lose sight of in a very busy, frenetic existence. And if there's one thing that we might be able to take home from this experience is the significance of attending to people in all of who they are in our interactions with them. And I think if we can do a better job with that, then we will end up better than we were before this all started.
That is a beautiful note to end on, Karen. Thanks for that really uplifting final thought. And thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Our guest has been Karen Storr, professor of philosophy at Georgetown University, author of Minding the Gap, Moral Ideals and Moral Improvement, and a coronavirus ethics column for the Washingtonian magazine. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a COVID conundrum that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog.
And whether or not you have anything to share with us, we hope you stay safe and healthy throughout the current crisis. Now a man so quick he makes COVID sick, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian shows that COVID seems more an inconvenience than a catastrophe. No fires, no floods, nothing concrete to make it real. You'll never see a movie in a theater again, maybe. Let that sink in, except it hasn't not happened yet. Lockdown should sober us up. Think about what brought us to the sorry pass. Climate change, overpopulation, globalism, where to go from here? Make the world better. Why not? Thinking is free. Honest to God, how much Netflix can you take? Instead, we come up with conspiracy theories. Bill Gates invented the Rona so he can sell us a vaccine. The Chinese invented the Rona to make Donald Trump look bad. So, go to war with China? Trump thinks so, I think. So we'll vote for him some more. Or the QAnon theory. Maybe Hillary Clinton and Democrats conspired to freak us out about the COVID, so we'll lock down, ruin the economy, and make Donald Trump look bad. When he loses the election, bam, there goes COVID, just a big hoax trick. And if Trump wins, we'll go to war with Democrats, or democracy, or whatever, and we'll have viruses until the cows come home. So we twiddle and yearn. You can't make moral choices if you don't even know what you're deciding about. Trump won't make the effort. He won't even test. If it's bad news, he'll look bad. If it's good news, Dems will take the credit. As I write this, there's talk of reopening the country, but how much were we even closed? I can go to the drugstore, but not a movie. I can buy a beer, but not a haircut. What is the disaster? Are we ready for work again? What if the office is contagious? What's the danger? If the house is on fire, where's the smoke? It's only been 2 months, but we're already tired of a thing that hasn't cost us much besides money, a life here and there. And we shut it down. Why? Trump decided to go all federalist to make his laziness seem like a political choice. He made the states do the work, but only made it easy for states that voted for him. Georgia reopened. Have they had more cases or less? Did they cook the numbers? Conservatives accused Governor Cuomo of causing unnecessary deaths at senior centers, even though they're the ones suggesting that maybe we sacrifice old sick people to get things booming again. Now, people with machine guns are showing up at state legislatures demanding that the economy reopen. Who are they going to shoot if it doesn't? A simple letter to the editor would have been more persuasive. But we don't have newspapers anymore. The right wing hated those too because fake news. Well, come on, it wasn't all fake. Weather was real. Comic sports was on TV tonight. Well, not anymore. It's all Netflix, Netflix, Netflix. Maybe a little Zoom thrown in. Now the internet has all that stuff and it's harder to find. And if you do a search for weather, chances are you'll find links to chemtrails and climate change when all you want is a picture of a cloud with zigzags coming out of it. Is it raining or not? That's all you want to know. Also, if you get your job back, will you take your machine gun to work in case the doctor comes around with a tape measure and make sure you're social distancing? Or maybe you'll stay home then, get in shape for the Civil War to come. Except I'm not getting the full benefit of immunity-boosting smoothies because the fashion bloggers selling them are gone. All the influencers, shut down, ruined. You can order designer shoes, but who's making them? We can take up our arms and make them design shoes, but how will we get them if Trump refuses to fund the post office, much less vote by mail? Still, it's only been 2 months. There have been castle sieges that lasted longer. The Donner Party didn't even start eating their own until 3 months in. I think that's true. If it's not, go ahead and shoot me. You've got the gun, but don't come knocking unless you're wearing a mask. Now, hang on, I'll tell you what. If you put the gun down, I'll give you a free haircut and a beer. The haircut will be terrible, and the beer alcohol-free, but what do you want? It's a disaster. So they tell me. Not everybody's acting like it, but disaster is what I heard. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program did not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
You have a responsibility, not only to protect yourself, but you almost have a societal, moral responsibility to protect other people.